Boys and girls, we have a very interesting guest today. She is Maridel LeSueur of Minneapolis. We're presenting her recent book, The River Road, A Story of Abraham Lincoln. This story tells in a very live, sensitive language of Abe's trip on his raft down the Mississippi in his late teens. Miss LeSueur, thank you for the pleasure this book gave me. I think I never quite knew the teenage Abe Lincoln before.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because I think he was really developing with the country, growing up with the country.
Yes, I think he was, and you certainly have given that picture. And we have a panel of young people here from St. Paul, and I think we'll find out who they are and from what schools they come. They want to talk to you a little later about your book.
I'm Maria Landy, and I'm from Central High School.
I'm Mary Dorn from Mechanic Arts High School.
I'm from Murray High, and my name is Cookie Johnson.
I'm Karen Anderson from Murray High School.
I'm from Murray High School, too, and my name is Sandra Schaffner.
Well, these are the people that want to talk to you a little bit later, and they've read several of your books, and they'll tell you about that, too, I think. And now I think we'll have our storyteller introduce us to the story. So let's call on Jack Lester to tell us something from The River Road by Maridel LeSueur.
It was late in the fall in the new state of Indiana in the year 1828. And this boy I'm going to tell you about had just gone outside and had just slammed the lean-to door on his pa's yellow dog to keep him from barking. This boy I'm telling you about could just write his name, Abraham Lincoln. And he had read 3 books, although he was nigh on 18 years old. He had just slammed the door to the lean-to, for he didn't want his parents to hear the yellow dog howling at him. He wanted to be gone from there. Abe thrust open the door to the Jones store. It banged back, and every man there looked up to see a gaunt, dirty-faced scarecrow who looked like a man but had the gangling look of a boy to him, as if he wasn't used to being so tall, reaching so far so soon, standing so high. Abe saw his cousin, Dennis Hanks, by the Cracker Barrel, McSweeney, the Irish schoolteacher, Grigsby and Crawford, his bosses, and old man Gentry and his young son, Alan. The Kentucky attorney, Mr. Breckinridge, had just said, "Let the South keep their slaves." They all greeted him.
"Howdy, Abe. Howdy, Abe Lincoln. Well, Abe, how is it up there? How's the weather up there?"
That was a stale joke he had learned to grin and bear to keep from socking the joker.
"His pa taught him to work, but he says he never taught him to love it. He ain't much for work, but can he tear through one of them books?"
Alan Gentry, Abe's age, a pale youth who was going to school, spoke.
"I watched him working for my pa cutting posts, and I barely could see him moving."
Old Grigsby patted his little fat stomach.
"Abe ain't much for work."
Abe grinned. "And you ain't much for paying for work." They all piped up with their 2 cents worth.
"Why, there ain't nobody can fell buckeyes and hickories like Abe. Well, he can carry a load of 3 men and 2 horses. We was moving our chicken coop, weighed nigh on 600 pounds. And that boy picks it up just like a baby, carried it over, and puts her down fine as silk."
Alan Gentry's father spoke.
"Well, I seen him pick up a 44-gallon barrel. He's just the man to take my produce downriver before the ice comes."
He and Abe looked at each other, taking a measure that would show who would keep a deal, pay honest, fight hard. Mr. Breckinridge, the lawyer from Kentucky, put his lace-cuffed hand on Abe's shoulder.
"Here's a smart boy. Reading maketh a full man."
Mr. Breckinridge was a pro-slavery man, and you had to protect yourself from the cunning of his words as from a poisonous berry. But McSweeney, the Irish schoolteacher, edged up and thrust himself between Abe and Mr. Breckinridge, shaking his fist and his huge red head so his starved body shook. He shook his long finger.
"Here are all your bosses, Abe Lincoln, setting judgment on you, scrounging out your blood. Suckers, eels they are. Crawford, what does he pay you for looking after his store, running his ferry?"
"I pay him a good sum for a man who is behind every haycock with his nose in a book,"
McSweeney was outraged. Yeah, 2 bits a day, sun up to sundown, and making him work shucking corn 3 days to pay for a lousy book by Parson Weems that got spoiled in the rain. Abe hitched his long legs one over the other. It was sure worth it. All about Valley Forge and George Washington. You could amount to something, Abe, if you'd keep your nose out of them books. Mr. Gentry, there's some argumentation about what use a man is that lends money out at big interest that breaks the back of the settler. Your paw's a no-good hunting man. Don't tend to his acres. My paw works longer, harder, digs deeper, plants oftener than any man in these parts. And the interest goes to you. No need to get huffy. I got a proposition to make to you, Abe. I got a load of port, flour, and sundry I'd like to see what it would bring down in New Orleans. Now, I hear you got a raft. How'd you like to go with my son Alan here, under his command, of course, down the river? Alan ain't no river man. Are you, Abe Lincoln? I've been as far down as you. That's just around the bend, as far as your eye can see. You trust me, Mr. Gentry, to take your goods down?
Don't know anyone, Abe, I'd trust more. And my son Alan, too, my only son.
Will you hold my paw's debt till I get back?
Oh, sure will that.
How much you pay?
8 a month and grub.
And my way back?
Well, it would be mighty good experience for you to work your way back on one of those newfangled steamers.
McSweeney flared up.
Hold out, Abe. Make the old skinflint pay your passage back.
My way back?
To St. Louis.
To St. Louis. If Alan has to hike it from there with me. Be a good experience for him. Learn to rough it.
I'll give you that farm when you get back, Alan. Abe will make a man of you.
Oh, I don't know. Wouldn't want to interfere with the Almighty's intentions.
All right, Alan. We'll take off soon as we load her.
Thank you, Jack Lester, for that introduction to the River Road by Merida LeSueur. Now, the young people we met a little earlier, all from St. Paul, are ready to talk to Merida LeSueur about her book, and a more interesting book to discuss I just can't imagine. So, Muriel, why don't you start the ball rolling?
I'd like to know, what made you want to write about Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I came up in the Abraham Lincoln country in Illinois, and then my family came across almost the same trails that his family did, you know, from Kentucky and Indiana and Illinois, and well, they went on into Kansas and Oklahoma. But so I always felt that I was part of the country and the growing up that he experienced. Don't you feel like he's the sort of in his adolescence just feels exactly like the rest of us?
Yes, it makes you feel like you're right there.
Uh-huh.
I enjoyed your book very much too, and I was wondering if all these incidents, I never heard of many of them before. I knew that he had taken a trip on the river when he was a young boy, but I never heard much about it, and it's sort of afresh for me, and I enjoyed it very much, and I was wondering if he really had all these incidents happen to him.
Well, I wouldn't make up anything about a person like Abe Lincoln, because there's so much rich material, you have to choose from it, and no one would dare make up anything, so everything I took from what other people talked, everyone talked about Abe, you know, anyone who ever met him, he was so high, and so people told about him. So everything is based, even the things that people said, actually, I took from records or people that told about them. So nothing is made up.
And the way they said them.
Yes.
That's what intrigued me in her book, didn't it, you, Mary?
Oh, I especially enjoyed the language used in the book. Parts of it were so poetical in their own way.
They were indeed. I think this book would read aloud wonderfully. Don't you think so, girls?
Yeah.
Yes, it should be read aloud.
I think it should.
Well, I think that in those times, people spoke a lot of poetry. Well, they do now, too. And it was part of their using an axe, you know, makes a sort of rhythm, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In writing a book like that, you can have, you can change the mood so very much to fit the mood that you may be, you know, in just at the moment that you're reading it. And it tells in different parts, like when he goes up to his mother's grave, how he takes and mourns there, and then you just sort of feel mourning yourself, and you feel bad and all through, and then happy parts when he, all different, you know, different parts in the book when he when he's real happy about something else, and it just makes you want to laugh along with him.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to show, that when you're young, you're sometimes sad. Sometimes books never tell you that, you know, but you're very sad. And we feel
I'm
better.
I'm sure Abe Lincoln was.
Sure. Well, we are too sometimes.
Yes, certainly.
You know?
I thought it made me feel that he was more like a man before. I just thought of him as a character in history, sort of, and now I think I know that he was enjoyed many of the things that every other girls and boys do, too.
Yes, I think it helps us to live ourselves when we see a man of this kind who feels all the things that all people feel. That's the thing that makes him great.
I think the younger kids would like that because of the incidents he had and of how he was happy and unhappy, and so I think they'd enjoy it.
And then, of course, he had to do all those chores we all still have to do, you know. We don't have to chop wood. But
no.
I wonder how many of us have to do as many as he did, though.
There's a lot of help nowadays with chores.
It points out how if you're told to go out and sweep the kitchen floor and that, and he had to take and not sweep the cabin floor, but take and just about shovel out everything because so many crowded in there. But you should make yourself not feel sorry for yourself when you read that, and you think, oh, what a life he really did lead. You
think you have life pretty easy in comparison?
Yes.
Yes, I think you do.
Well, we can all feel, too, I think, that we are great, too. I mean, sometimes we feel pretty small, but we are all great if we express those qualities of greatness.
I suppose it was all those little things he had to do at home and the big things, too, that molded his character to make him the president he was.
Well, he came to love people. That was the great thing about Abe. He had a great compassion. He loved the smallest soldier who slept at his post. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he loved people, and he got that from his days when he worked hard and understand suffering and understand the pioneer life and his mother.
Do you think young people of your age have as definite opinions about what is going on in the world as he had?
I think he had more because he was right there with those slaves and how he got, how those slaves attacked him that time, that he just remembered that over his whole life. And wanted,
he understood their bitterness.
Yes, and he saw that they were just afraid of white men, not just every man. And that they were just afraid of him because they had to work for him, and he understood that all people should be free because that was what the Constitution said.
Yes, I thought that book brought out that very well. And I think the great thing is that you realize that he felt deeply at a very young age, and that made him think, and that's what made him one of the great thinkers of our entire world.
Well, I think this conversation shows that these people are feeling deeply also.
I think so, too. I think so.
This
is a very nice group of girls, and I'm very happy to have had you here today, you St. Paul people. And it's been fine to have you, Mary Dilla, sir.
Well, I've enjoyed
and
it.
And congratulations on that fine book, The River Road. It really is an unusual one, I think.
Thank you very much.
And now back to our announcer.
You're recording now, you
yeah,
know.
You do.
You want to record it?
Yeah.
Okay, now what do you want to say?
I want to say a lot of things.
Shut up and quit down.
My mom is ready to go now.
A special war bulletin.
And my special war bulletin. Ricky, bye, folks. That's all for now.
Ricky, special war bulletin. It's time to go home. It's after 12 o'clock at night on this day of our Lord when the moon is shining, and it's time to close up shop.
I forgot shining bright.
And
stack of the ears.
And you can't hear yourself think. And your head is going around, you know, and
that's a
Okay, talk now. Oh,
let me
talk. No, I'm talking. And Davy Crockett.
Hello, folks. I'm Richard Jacobson. Goodbye, folks.
Yeah.
Hello.
Go to hell.
Go to hell.
Rub your ears. Killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier.
No, just talk.
Well,
I wanted to tell about a couple of experiences I had at school with tape recording. And one of them was that our teacher had had a sprain about an hour before. He'd fallen down on the stairs of the high school. And so he decided he had to go to the doctor's office. So he decided to leave the room and the children all by themselves. Well, we didn't know it then, but he had hidden a tape recorder and he turned it on just before he left. Well, of course, everyone was commenting about his lovely personality and his gorgeous assignments and all the wonderful things he'd done for the school. You can imagine what that would be. And so finally, someone said, well, here comes Mr. Luddington, so we better be quiet. So everyone was very busily studying when he walked in the room. And so when he came in the room, he turned on the tape recorder, and we heard ourselves, and oh, what an uproar. Everyone was just going about nuts. And the whole class had to stay after school, so we decided we'd sort of make a little play sort of thing, but it didn't turn out, and we never did get to hear it again. But that was quite a deal, because we learned the true value of taping and recording.
Ministers, and he came out there, preached a while where my mother lived. I've heard him say how one Sunday morning at Greer, Ohio, he was looking down the congregation, and his blue eye caught the reflection of a black eye in the congregation, and that was fatal. And when he'd say that, my mother would say, "Oh, Frank."
How was the town named Africa?
Well, this place, Africa, was where they went to soon after they were married, Africa, Ohio, near Columbus, Ohio. It was at that time called East Orange, but the name was being changed because East Orange, Ohio, had been a station on the Underground Railroad in the effort to help Negroes escape from slavery to freedom in Canada. So that's why it was called Africa. My father was a minister there of a small Wesleyan Methodist church that had pulled out of the old Methodist church because they wanted an opportunity to help the slaves become free. There were a good many Methodist abolitionists. There were becoming more and more of them, but they did not have freedom to speak their mind in the old Methodist church. And so they had to get out of that church if they wanted to say what they wanted to about freedom for the Negroes. And that's why this Wesleyan Methodist Church was formed. The first, one of the great ministers of the old Methodist Church, his name was Orange Scott, a Vermonter. And he was one of the main leaders in this movement from the old Methodist Church to form this anti-slavery Methodist Church called Wesleyan Methodist.
And what is it now? What kind of a church is it now?
That church, there's still such a church, Wesleyan Methodist. Underground station is right. Well, I've heard my mother say, I was very much inclined to cough and to get the croup. And so she'd pick me up by my heels and knock the croup out of me, pound me on the back. This little town of Africa, just a little crossroads place, the church and a little store, and the blacksmith shop, as I recall. I was there a few years ago, the children's mother and myself. Yes, our first boy, Ben, was along. And at that place, when I was there a few years ago, as well as when I was there before my father was along, so that was several years ago, there were no Negroes living in the town at all, even though it had been a station on the Underground Railroad to help Negroes to freedom. Mm. Their mother were married on Thanksgiving Day, 1882, and November 14, that's a week hence from now, I was born at this place called Africa. And we stayed there 1 year, and then my father wanted to get more schooling. And so he drove a horse and buggy, a sorrel horse, as I remember I've heard them say, that my grandmother Hicks, my mother's mother, had given them. He drove that pony and the buggy from Africa near Columbus, Ohio, out to New York State to go to school. It was a new school of the Wesleyan Methodist Church where they felt they should educate their ministers, and where I also went to school after I grew up. Hmm. So I went to school with my father when I was 1 year old. My oldest to Houghton, and it looked like it'd be a poor place to be, but they came to like it very much. Although my father felt he didn't have the wonderful soil Indiana had where he grew up. This region, and there I can remember going after milk, and I fell down on the stone step one frosty morning and bumped my head, so I got a bump. That was part of my bump of knowledge. Father finally went on west as far as Kansas, and he grew up there on a farm where he was a local minister. And they were often talking about Houghton, where they'd been to school. And so after I had finished high school out there, a Quaker academy it was, I went to Houghton, New York to go to school, where I spent at least five years in school. Preaching all the time with other preachers besides my father, and it was kept before me, it'd be a good thing to be a preacher. That was a way to make the world better. And of course my father was a preacher. I thought he was quite a preacher. I didn't see how I could ever preach anything like he did. And he would say, and I can remember when he was preaching in the little town of North Branch, Kansas, near where we lived, in the little Wesleyan Methodist Church there. He happened to be the conference evangelist that year, and he was preaching on a quartering occasion and saying something about his boys, how they should be preaching better than he did, and I never saw how it could ever be that I'd preach as good as he did. So eventually I began to think maybe I should be a preacher, and it wasn't long till they were putting me up to preach once in a while right there in that little church. There's a Quaker church there too. I was quite a Quaker as well as a Methodist in church. We were in school, in high school there in that little town. And on fifth day, Thursday, the fathers and mothers of the school would come in from the country round about, and they'd have fifth day meeting, prayer meeting at 11 o'clock. We'd put our books away and sit there for an hour. Once in a while there wouldn't be a word said the whole time. So I learned what it was to sit still in a quiet meeting for an hour. And the way we knew when it was over was that people sitting up in front would turn to each other and shake hands, and that was the dismissal. Feeling the preachers are always preaching that you must be converted from your sins, and I couldn't figure I had any, but still, if I hadn't done something I thought I should, I felt kind of bad about it. So I supposed I need to be converted. And some of the boys would say to me at school, "Well, you never swear, do you, Harold?" I said, "Oh yes, I swear inside." But I began to feel that kind of inside ought to be made better, so I got converted and figured I ought to preach too. But it was a feeling, something about a religious feeling, included a moral outlook also. It made me feel that, well, that's the way to help people to be better. And if you can get everybody converted, we'll have a wonderful world. But of course this Quaker indoctrination that you must be for peace. Learned that too there. That was a little different than we got in the Methodist Church, that we must always be for peace. Now, wasn't much said there, but still it seemed to drift inside me there at that place, and I think that was the beginning of my feeling for peace, this Quaker. The later teaching college in this little Wesleyan Methodist school out in New York State at Houghton, where I had been when I was a year old with my folks, and later graduated from the college there before I went on to Oberlin to finish college. But I came back there and taught in that college, and while I was there teaching political science and history, I was quite a prohibitionist, my father had been, and we had a meeting in Rochester, New York, prohibitionists and socialists. There's an effort to get the two together. It felt it could accomplish more. And I heard at a last meeting in Rochester in a small independent Wesleyan Methodist church there. There were a few socialists there as well as prohibitionists. And I heard there Rose Pastor Stokes speak. And she was saying that the trouble with the is it's got too many things wrong with it. But the cure for these things that are wrong with democracy is more democracy. Not less, but more democracy. And she talked about the initiative, referendum, and recall. And my studies in political science tend to think that you mustn't turn things over to people who don't know anything, just have people who know something. That seems strange. Well, so I expostulated with her after I'd heard it. Now, I was teaching political science in this junior college, so I expostulated at the close of the meeting with Rose Pastor Stokes and said, why, we surely cannot make a better democracy by getting more ignorant people in it. And she says, how are you going to cure it then? Are you going to have less democracy and just have a few folks that own everything, give us more democracy? Not as much as they had in the earlier day when Oberlin was the first. Was almost the first co-educational school in the country. Yeah, well, the first co-educational school in the country, and almost the first charge of was when I was going to school in Houghton and taking college work there, and I had a little student church out in the country where my father had preached when he was there, short track. That is the first church I had, holding a revival meeting one winter there, and wanted somebody to come and help me. He said, you can do it. So I was preaching and laying it out how people have got to be converted from their sins. And we had several that got converted and felt that I had done quite a thing for them. But one of these people that got converted, I found him drunk at another place. Oh. And rode home with him.
It didn't take.
It wasn't complete, but still
his wife. Gone back.
Yes. He must have done for your spirit.
His wife felt very bad when he came home that he was that way, but they still never went back on me, either one of them. Negro, and they wouldn't consent to that. But I don't, that's all. But my father, you can have that later. My father had a Negro singing for him there in Indiana, and he is one that I love very much. He's very friendly. And when I grew up and heard about him, I wanted to go to see him as I went to Indiana. And I asked my uncles there about him. Well, they said that he won't be at the camp meeting. Well, why? Oh, why, don't you know what happened to him? Why, no. Well, we had to put him out of the church, out of the conference. Well, why was that? Well, what did he do that was so bad? Oh, well, don't you know? Why, he married a white woman. And my father had suggested that to me before. It didn't take me by surprise, but I acted like it did. But I went to visit him and found his family, a nice family, that he'd sing in the town as he had before. I didn't see him, but he was in good standing.